MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Brent. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Did you work over the weekend?
I certainly did my show on Sunday night, but didn't do any medical work. But we're moving house soon, so my wife and I did all the packing and all that sort of fun things.
Why don't you get someone to do that for you?
A lot of stuff is just personal stuff. You want to package yourself, right. You know, other people go. And I'm packing all my study up, all my books where, and I know they're going to be where I want them to be when I get to the other place.
That's are you building or buying?
Oh, we just built a new house.
Just built a new house?
Yeah.
Same. Well, that must have been fun.
Look, my wife's an interior designer and she's got wonderful taste, and so I just leave it all up to her. And I'm totally useless. Put me in front of a patient or a microphone, I'm pretty good, but anything else, I'm completely useless, so I leave all the decisions up to her.
You're a lucky man.
Absolutely.
Lucky man. I wish I... It's sort of the other way around in our relationship, my wife and I.
No. I'm just hopeless. And I don't have a clue about colours and whatever, and so she's designed the whole house. It's just beautiful. So.
And so when do you move in?
Thursday.
Thursday?
Yeah.
You must be excited.
Yeah, very excited.
How long did you live at the other place for?
Oh, we've been renting for a couple of years. We got one of those sort of weird offers you couldn't refuse. I won't make any racist comments about it, but we had an offer you couldn't refuse, and we took the offer. So we didn't really. Our house wasn't for sale. We just got a knock on the door from someone and said, "We want to buy a house. It's not for sale. Go away."
Is that true?
It was this really good offer, so we had to take it.
There you go. So you get a new house out of it.
Mm.
All right, we'll think of you on Thursday. Let's talk all things medical. I've got a whole host of things to talk about, but let's, if we can, start with your article, or one of the articles that you wrote that you sent me, and it's called The True Epidemic of the 21st Century.
Yeah.
And you talk about COVID-19 and a vaccine and the availability of a vaccine. Is this the article I'm referring to here?
No, there's two articles.
This is the second one.
Vaccine.
This is the diabetes?
The true epidemic is diabetes, which is a combination of diabetes and obesity. It's going to kill many more people over the next century than will COVID-19. Now, I'm not demeaning COVID-19 at all. It's killed around a million people around the planet. It's a very serious condition, very contagious, etc., etc. But we're talking about the fact that there are millions and millions of people who have type 2 diabetes. There are millions and millions of people who are obese and overweight, and that is the real epidemic of our modern world. And people have to understand, our bodies were designed to wander around a jungle for 30, 40 years with a spear looking for food. So if the food wasn't there, you went hungry. But these days, it's our God-given right to always fill our bellies. And so we have breakfast, lunch, and dinner and sit in our bums all day, and we wonder why we get overweight. So researchers around the world are looking for the holy grail to allow people to continue their dreadful lifestyles, but be able to treat obesity. And at the moment, we have an operation people can have on their stomachs, which is highly effective, but there's another thing that's also highly effective. It's called don't eat as much food and do more exercise. But probably what you didn't realize, and this is what I spoke about in the article, is that we have different types of fat. Now, everyone knows about the HDL and LDL being good and bad cholesterol. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about the difference between white fat and brown fat. Had you ever heard of them before?
I had, yeah. I had heard of it.
Well, what brown fat is the fat that little babies and infants have, which actually burns energy and reduces sugar and fat. But as we get older, we lose that brown fat. If you're lucky, you've got a little bit just under your collarbones, and that's about it. And the rest becomes white fat, which most people can see around their belly. And that, in fact, when you look at that fat, it's not white, it's yellow. But for the purpose of this argument, let's just stick to the brown fat, white fat story. And what they did was use this gene editing technology, these are people in the US, to boost the expression of a particular gene called UCP1. The name doesn't matter. But what UCP1 does is take human white fat cells in their primitive stage, before they've actually become established white fat cells, and the UCP1 then converts these white fat cells into brown fat cells. And they found that when they injected these into mice, they called them humble cells for a weird reason, they transplanted these into mice, and the mice markedly improved their insulin sensitivity, because most people are insulin resistant, which is the bad thing to be, and had a much better chance of clearing the glucose from the blood and less weight gain by being injected with these cells. So what they're suggesting is that what they may be able to do is by some sort of gene technology improve the expression of this UCP1 in human beings to be able to make more brown fat as opposed to white fat, which I thought was also interesting. And the second part of the article was a study that came out of the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, where they looked at a thing called GWAS, which is a study of genes in a whole lot of people, 450,000 people, and they did some RNA sequencing from a whole lot of different mice cell populations or mouse cell populations, and they found that there were a whole lot of areas of the brain that seemed to contribute to obesity, things like sight, smell and taste. So when you see food, you smell the food, you taste the food, in processes sensory stimuli in your brain, and also other areas of the brain are overdeveloped for things like feeding and behavior related to learning and memory. But the problem with this argument, this particular argument about genes, is that everyone thinks that you are a victim of your genes. And a lot of people don't realize that less than 5% of our genes are fixed. The other 95% of our genes are in the activated or inactivated state. So if you overeat, you then would activate a set of genes that then codes into your brain to overexpress things in this area. So it's not actually the fact that you're born that way and that's why you do this stuff. People overeat because they're depressed, because they want comfort, because that's what they're primed to do. You remember when we were kids, your mother, I don't know if your mother used this argument with you, Brent, but my mum used to always say, eat your dinner, there are starving people in India. And you'd think, well, hang on, by me eating this dinner, is it going to make their food any better? But that's the point. You had this guilt put into you as a child that if you didn't finish your meal, then something was wrong. And so that can change what's going on in your brain. So obesity isn't just a simple matter of you were born that way. There are many factors involved.
I think one of the major problems we have in this country is the portion sizes. I mean, if you don't get a plate full of food in a restaurant, you feel like you've been ripped off.
Yep.
And when you come home, I mean, I've noticed it with what we cook at home. You seem to fill that plate. If you have I've often cooked some pasta and you'll put all the pasta on the plate and you'll think, gee, I don't really need that.
Yeah, but then you finish it anyhow.
And
since the introduction of the all-you-can-eat salad bar, and there's never any salad there, but it's since the introduction of that, that's when the obesities really happen, when people are just... my wife and I went to America about 20 years ago, and we ordered a meal, which was just what we call an entree, between us, and we couldn't finish. We split it. We still couldn't finish it. The portion size was just ridiculous.
All right, let's... quick question. Can you see a time when we'll be able to take a tablet and it will control our weight?
Look, I think yes. I think we're headed to that. Do I want that? No, because I think it just then promotes gluttony, and I don't think gluttony is good for you emotionally anyhow. And I think also when you think about it at a more global level, we don't have endless resources on this planet, and the more we overconsume, we're just ruining the resources that we've got. We've got to have a more of a global view than just fill our own bellies and what keeps us happy.
Do you see there's a time when there'll be a tablet that you take it and it helps in reference to vascular fitness?
Oh, yeah. I think there's tablets for all these things. The research that's being done around the world for all of this is quite extraordinary. I think all of these things are happening.
Goodness. Okay, let's talk about your other article. And this is about COVID-19 and the vaccination and the pros and the cons. I thought this was an interesting article.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think some of the anti-vaxxers probably wouldn't have been too happy with what I was saying.
No, that's true.
But what we have to decide, if and when this vaccine becomes available, and by the look of it, with this Oxford vaccine, we did have that hiccup a few weeks ago with the one case of transverse myelitis. And again, people will say, oh, see, it's dangerous, cause this one thing. But this is the problem with any condition. I've seen people in their 20s die of influenza, but most people don't. And so when you expose anyone to any virus or any toxin at all, there will be that one or two people out of a million who will have an adverse reaction to it. So to give you the best example there, we've all heard of the condition measles. Now, why is measles dangerous? We used to have measles parties as kids, so we'd all have measles and have immunity to it. Well, measles is dangerous because 1 in 1,000 children who get measles get a thing called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, which leaves them intellectually disabled for the rest of their days. If you give the measles vaccination, it's 1 in 10,000 get that condition. So you can still get it from the vaccination, but you just don't get it as much. You get it 10 times more from getting measles. So in the same way, the coronavirus has devastated a lot of people. So it's what I call the 80-10-10 rule. 80% of people get coronavirus, just get a mild illness, and they get better. 10% get a bit sick, like, say, President Trump, but still appear to be improving, and that's great. The other 10% are the ones who get the long COVID or even die from the condition, where their cytokines just go into overdrive. So we're talking about many, many more people being affected by the disease than the one person out of 30,000 so far who's had a significant complication from the vaccination. But then we've got to start having the question right now, and I think your listeners should be calling in and we should be talking about this. If you refuse to have the vaccination, and that is your God-given right, no one has any right to force medical therapy on anyone, in my view. But if you refuse to have that vaccination, do you then rescind your right to travel, rescind your right to go to restaurants, rescind your right to go to big sporting events or whatever, based on your own conscientious objection, which I think that's fine if you want to do that, but you've got to realise your liberties aren't going to be the same as people who put their hand up for the vaccination. And then you might use the argument, which is a crappy one, by the way, oh, no, but I'm not going to have the vaccination, and if I get sick, I'll put up with being sick. But then the sicker, older, more vulnerable people whose immune systems may not work so well, we want to get COVID out of the community. The only way we can do that is by having at least 70% of the population vaccinated. That's the only way, or 70% of the population being exposed. So that's a crappy argument to say, I know, I'm happy to get it, and I'll take my own chances. And also, why should we pay for the medical expenses for people who refuse to have a proven treatment?
Yeah, very true, very true. Interesting article. It's available on Dr. Ross's Facebook website. We're talking to Dr. Ross Walker. We'll take a break and come back very shortly.